We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're listening to Setting the Pace, your go-to Pacers podcast. With Alex Golden and Michael Facci.
Sabonis down the lane with authority.
Oh, Miles Turner bringing that smoke.
Clifford skies high for the jam.
Warren lets it fly.
Yes! T.J. Warren is not human.
The Setting the Pace podcast had Kevin Pritchard on.
Well, you got it setting the pace, and I think that's terrific.
What up, Pacer Nation? Welcome back to another episode of Setting the Pace. I'm your host, Alex Golden, and I'm joined today with my co-host, the one and only Michael J. Facci. Facci, we've got a loaded episode today.
Action-packed today. We have J. Michael joining us. He is dropping some very insightful information that you're not going to want to miss, and it's getting me excited about the next head coach, because we're diving into everything that went wrong with our last head coach, Nate Bjorkgren.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of things, just the craziness of this year, what the Pacers could do moving forward, the head coaching search, when he anticipates a decision being made. We talk about the NBA draft, TJ Warren, Aaron Holiday, anybody you think we should talk about, we pretty much talk about it. So it's going to be a fun episode. Let's not waste any time. We'll get out of the way and get right to our conversation with J. Mike.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Joining us now on the line is J. Michael from the Indy Star. Jay, how's it going, man?
Been going pretty good, I guess, considering. Not too bad. Better. I always say this, better than the Pacers are doing right now. It seems like
that's true.
Yeah, so let's get right into it. So obviously we had the firing of Bjorkgren last week, and I think a lot of Pacer fans were anticipating this firing. One of the things that I was interested by was, you know, some of the reporting that came out that, you know, the Pacers might be interested, or Kevin Pritchard might be more interested in rebuilding than trying to win. And there was, I think it was in the Woj report, saying something along the lines of, you know, they might have retained Bjorkgren if they were wanting to go in a rebuild mode. Is that any way true? I mean, does Kevin Pritchard, in your mind, or from what you've heard, kind of want to rebuild instead of keep running it back?
I think what I had in my report last week suggested that it's basically going to be up to Herb Simon on what direction they go. But Kevin is more inclined to, he's really open to the idea of tearing this thing down, were making some significant moves, maybe taking another step back in order to go a few steps forward. He's more on that side of it than Herb Simon, but it would require Herb to say, okay, let's go ahead and do this. You know, it's like a lot of things, you know, it depends on, you know, you go to a lot of teams in the league and, you know, you hear people make comparisons where this team did this and see the Pacers aren't have enough courage to do this. That GM, Pritchard or whomever, doesn't have the courage. Well, it's not necessarily that. They may want to do it. But if the guy who ultimately signs the checks doesn't want to do it, then it's not going to be done. And I think that's the position the Pacers are in. But, yeah, if you told me that Kevin Pritchard, it was his call whether or not to shake this team up or not and make some significant moves, I say the answer would be yes, undoubtedly yes. So, yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. I think that's what would happen. Whether Bjorkman being retained, if they went that direction, I don't believe that would have happened. I think that's been put on in favor of Bjorkman's agent to make him look better, and be honest. I mean, I don't know that for a fact that that's not true. But based off of what I do know that is true, there is absolutely no way they could have run that back. Had those guys come back to training camp and have Bjorkman with the guy blowing the whistle to convene them, there's no way that would have happened. That would have basically been a move where you stay with Bjorkman and you fire him 2 weeks into the season, and then you're really behind. So that's what I hit. The relationships, not just with players, but with people around the organization. So he didn't just piss off players. You're talking about support staff that he did not treat well, that they were all upset with him for different reasons about different things. There's no way they could have run it back with him. That's impossible.
I just cannot imagine a scenario where they ran it back. I feel like it would have been kind of a dark cloud hanging around the team, the fan base and everything, almost waiting until that firing happens. And that definitely would have set the team back. But in the article that, you know, you published, Pritchard also mentioned that he's going to consult a few of the players on the next hire, but not sure to what extent. Now, which players do you think in specific he would consult?
I don't think he's consulting anybody. You know, that's a slippery slope to go down.
It is.
Some of these players that you have may not be on your team when this is all said and done. So why would you consult guys when, let's face it, is there anybody on the team that you would consider untradeable? No. So the biggest problem, I mean, he said he talked to and listened to certain guys if they wanted to, throw their hat in the ring and say, look, this is what I would like in a coach. But I don't think he's going to make his decision based on what those players want, because players want, they didn't want Nate McMillan. And so you got rid of Nate McMillan. You gave him somebody that was supposed to be the anti or the opposite of Nate McMillan. It becomes a question of, now that you've taken McMillan out of the variable away from the team, now, even though you may not have hired the right coach to replace him, which is a completely different topic, it does bring into question the things that you heard Pritchard say postseason about needing leadership in the locker room. And it's kind of funny. I posed this question to somebody probably in about January or February. I says, I don't think you guys have the right – based off what I was being told back then, I was like, now that you've changed the coach, you have certain personality issues still there. And Oladipo is now gone. And Oladipo wasn't the best teammate in that locker room either. So now you have no Nate, no Oladipo, a lot of the same stuff. And it kind of, begs the question, okay, you've changed coaches, may not be the right coach, but the way your players are responding suggests you may not have the right players either. And so if you believe that you may need to change significantly some chunks of that roster, why are you going to make a decision based on what they feel? Because let's face it, if you're Kevin Pritchard, your job depends on this next hire. It really depends on this next hire, okay? So you're making that call based on what you think and what you feel, or maybe what you know, not based on the whim of a player who may or may not be there in the long run.
Yeah, and I think those are all great points. And, you know, going back a little bit to the Bjorkman era and his coaching staff, I know that he had a hard time assembling an assistant coaching staff, but I got a two-part question for you here. Number one, how was the player relationships with the assistant coaches? And number two, I guess based on that answer, do you anticipate any of those assistants getting an interview for the head coaching job or vacancy here for the Pacers?
I don't anticipate any of that. The latter part of your question, I don't anticipate that at all. You know, could happen, I guess. You know, I mean, they will talk to their share of people, but I just don't anticipate that. As a matter of fact, the one report that I had back in March going into the trade deadline is at a minimum that assistant coach and staff was going to be shaken up if Bjorken was to find a way to, you know, if the Pacers maybe would have finished a little bit stronger, made the playoffs, maybe won a game or two, they come back with Bjorken, then, you know, and he's able to kind of calm that storm, that regardless, at a minimum, they were going to shake up that staff. And I had that from multiple people who knew what was going on with that staff. The staff just wasn't strong enough. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why the staff wasn't strong enough is they couldn't get a better staff to surround him with, because nobody was willing to come to Indiana to coach under Bjorken. That's because, A, he didn't have relationships around the league with enough people to make somebody want to do that. He didn't have enough respect around the league to, you know, if you were an assistant coaching staff, and I'm just throwing this out there, like, you know, Denver or someplace like that, or Phoenix or Portland, why are you going to leave a job that you have some guarantees that you know, you have multiple years on your deal left to come coach for a guy who you barely know, maybe haven't heard the best things about anyway, and he's only got 2 years guaranteed on his deal. So they just couldn't get the kind of guys that you needed to put on a staff. So knowing that, they don't have – they basically felt like they had a skeleton staff when you get down to it. And and look, those guys, they were as upset as I had my March report not being able to do their jobs either. They clashed with Bjorken too. I mean, everybody – I mean, so you're talking about the players weren't happy. The coaches, assistant coaches weren't happy under Bjorken. There was support staff around that was not happy with Bjorken. As a matter of fact, I think it was the play-in game. It might have been another game, but it may have been the play-in game against Washington where someone told me that they were astounded with what they saw, how Bjorken treated the staff when they were, I think they were in D.C. So someone in D.C. told me they were astounded to see the way he treated staff. That was just somebody coming at me who contacted me when I was having a conversation, and that just came up and told me about certain things that was witnessed. So, yeah, I think with this thing, you got to just pull up this tree by the root and start over. I don't know if you can leave any remnants of what you just had in this past season, because that tree was poisoned from the root.
I truly do not know who would return back on that staff. So I completely, you know, hear where you're coming from. But, you know, injuries are always going to happen. It's part of the game. But say this wasn't a pandemic year and the schedule was a bit more normal, do you think things could have worked out a bit differently? Or is this just kind of, hey, this is just who Bjorken is, and it proved to be a bit overmatched in his first NBA head coaching job?
I think it's more the latter than the former. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you have, you know, for a guy going into this season, knowing what we know now about what the season was like, you had to really have a guy who was experienced, who really had good relationships. It would have been ideal to have a coach who already had relationships with some of these players from, you know, previous stops, because it could have helped maybe overcome some of those rough spots. So I think no doubt Bjorken's inexperience was part of it. Right. But given that you didn't have a chance to have the team dinners and hang out with each other in the same way, communicate in the same way that you would in a normal season, that made it tougher on Bjorken. But I believe, given what his strengths and weaknesses were as a coach, I don't really think that matters, that all of a sudden some of these relationships are healed, because you have, I think you are what you are. And, you know, maybe this situation made it ramp up a little bit sooner. Maybe it went off the rails a little bit quicker. But I think that was more of the issue. Like, you know, I've been going back and forth. You know, I was going back and forth with people for a while, I would get readers, people would email me and say, well, it's the injuries. Like, no, it's not the injuries. They have a lot. Every team in the league has injuries, and some significantly so too. I mean, there's a lot of teams that I think underperform because of the schedule and because of injuries, not just the Pacers. So it doesn't, you know, you're not all of a sudden special because it happened to you. It happened to other teams too. What I looked at was things like effort, communication. These guys didn't care about playing for one another at all, at all. And, you know, I knew that. I knew that probably when we got into March that was really starting to show. Then when I did my kind of piece after Bjorken got fired and I got into a little bit more detail and I talked to even more people, it was even worse than I thought. The word that was used to me is that they were a selfish group, did not play for each other at all. And I think Bjorken was the head of that snake. And because they didn't respect him and they didn't appreciate or respect where he was taking the team, some guys just decided, well, I'm going to get mine and do what I want. And of course, Bjorken lost a lot of respect when that happened. He didn't check the people who were doing that. He didn't check them at all. And the biggest culprit in all of that was Domantas Sabonis.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think one thing you brought up that's really interesting too is, you know, your source in Washington saying how poorly he treated his staff at that play-in game, if that was the game. Kind of surprising that, because that's after all the reports came out too. So it's like, you know, you think he'd be on his best behavior trying to save his job. And if he was acting that way, it's kind of hard to figure out. So let's go into that a little bit, because one of the things I noticed was, you know, Kevin Pritchard moving close to the bench in the middle of the season. And I just find it odd, you know, him cheering for the guys after home games, you know, when they're competing and whatever, but just, it's really odd to see a team president sitting that close to the bench in the middle of the season. Can you kind of elaborate on that and kind of elaborate a little bit more on Sabonis and some of the guys that were just, you know, not engaged and a little bit selfish?
Well, I mean, Kevin knew everything was going haywire with that group. And there was just a lot of, you know, one of the things that I did have in that report is Pritchard had to go into that locker room on at least four occasions and lay into those guys. I think when you saw Pritchard there on the sideline doing what he was doing, he knew where things had been, were heading or what was happening. And he went into that locker room twice. It was post game for some bad performances. And two other times it was pregame. After they had come off the road after getting stomped, and then their next game was at home. And so he went in there pregame to address the team. He has never had to go into the locker room to address the team since he's been in Indiana at any point. He did it four times in this season alone, which kind of gives you an indication of how dysfunctional everything was at that point. And that also shows that Bjorken didn't have control of his roster, that you needed the president down there basically to help do the job, to keep guys in line, because the head coach and the coaching staff wasn't able to do it. And he needed to give them positive reinforcement that I think those players felt that they were lacking throughout the season. The second part of your question was about Sabonis, was it not?
Yeah, just talking about him, and I believe your report said, you know, how him and Brogdon were being treated special, and then they kind of, you know, the players turned on the coaching staff after they were getting special treatment, and then, you know, those players kind of got frustrated with everything towards the end. So I don't know if it's just Sabonis that was necessarily the one that was being super selfish, like you just mentioned, but maybe Brogdon was as well.
Sabonis was by far the number one guy. Every time I point out what Sabonis doesn't do well, you know, there's always that group of people that comes up and recites his stats. But if you actually look at the games and see how they were played, that he got his numbers while, you know, playing longer minutes than he should have because they were getting the doors blown off. You know, stat stuff and isolating when he didn't need to isolate against superior defenders, over dribbling, that kind of stuff. And then you see the players around him get disengaged, and either they're not ready to catch and shoot, or they don't want to. They just like, go ahead, take it. You want to do it all yourself, do it all yourself. And it really becomes a chicken and egg thing sometimes. Like, is it because those guys aren't doing what they're supposed to do, so Sabonis is like, I'll take over? Or is it the other way around? I think it was more Domantas over dribbling and controlling the ball so much, and Bjorken would not, you know, address him at all for what, you know, he would get on other guys for what they weren't doing well or what they weren't doing right. But I thought – I always go back to the first time they played Utah, and it was in Utah. And the game, I think, was close or competitive in the first half, maybe first 2.5 quarters. And then Utah just blows them away. And to me, the whole key to that whole game was Sabonis was making some ridiculous isolation post-up attempts against Rudy Gobert that had no prayer. And the team just kind of mentally checked out. And I asked Bjorkman post-game, was that the plan? Was he okay with that? And he said, oh, yeah, I like that Domantas getting in there, digging a shoulder into Gobert. It was like one of those answers that I didn't expect. You know, you don't have to kill your player when you're asked the question, but you could say, yeah, we needed to play smarter and attack in a different way, get that guy moving side to side and then try to go at him. Isolating him probably wasn't the best idea, but we'll be better next time. That's a way you can address it without throwing your one, you know, an individual player under the bus. Mm-hmm. But instead, he gave this ridiculous answer that I said can't possibly be true. But apparently it was true. He was okay with Sabonis doing what he was doing, and the other players then knew better. I know a lot of people have difficulty trying to decipher the mixed messages because, you know, you have me reporting this and then you'll hear Bjorkman or one of the players saying, oh, it's great and it's okay. That's where deciphering information actually, you know, in talking to the right people, not just on record, but you talk to certain people on background or off the record, what is it really? And that's when you get real truthful, raw answers. And because it's like, you're insulting my intelligence. Isolating Gobert could not be part of the game plan. And so they went through that kind of stuff a lot during the season. And other people were suffering. Their games were suffering. But Bjorkman was criticizing them. He wouldn't criticize a guy like Sabonis. And Bjorkman and Brogdon, at least early on in the season, they used to sit down and have lunch with each other. Brogdon had Bjorkman's ear too quite a bit. It was a thing where he failed to – if you're not willing to put your best players in line, then, you know, basically everybody else just goes off and plays for themselves too. And that's why I use the word selfish, which was said to me on more than one occasion by more than one person with the team, that they played selfish ball as a result of that.
It truly a cringeworthy answer from Bjorkman as it relates to, you know, Sabonis. And, you know, a lot of guys put up career stats this year, but it did not translate to winning. And Alex and I had been extremely vocal that someone needed to hold these guys accountable. It's interesting to hear that, you know, Pritchard tried to be the one to do it. But we've been just so vocal that this team needed a veteran for so long. I mean, the last few seasons, it felt like. And you mentioned in your article that, you know, Pritchard even acknowledged it. They do need to add a veteran. Do you feel like maybe Brogdon was kind of talking a lot of talk and maybe it grew a bit stale because everybody kind of looked to him to be the leader of this team? And it kind of felt like halfway through the season that was long gone.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that gets back to, do you believe that is Brogdon going to be the number one voice in the locker room of a winning team? I mean, I don't know because I've never been, you know, we've never seen him. I mean, I guess the early returns would say no, right? But could he be a positive voice? Yeah. But is what you saw more, again, a function of a coach who just allowed everybody to go renegade? And if you put the right coach in place, that then he's a better leader and that sort of stuff. I think you look at the other thing with Brogdon, too. You know, misses a lot of time. His season was going pretty well until he got that hamstring injury. He got hurt. So I don't think if Sabonis and Brogdon are your two best players like they were this year, I don't really count LeVert having a full season with the Pacers. I don't think he count. I think in an ideal scenario, LeVert's one of your two best players, maybe your third best player if you have a really good champion, you know, a really good contending roster. But if Brogdon and Sabonis, I think they're your two best players. Most people will tell you, you know, I had somebody ask me this question. I had trouble finding an answer. They says, take Brogdon and Sabonis and you take another team who has whoever their two best players are on the 29 other teams. Would you trade the two best players on any of those other teams for some Brogdon and Sabonis just on talent and all that other stuff straight up? I had trouble coming up with any answers of who I would make that trade. You know, if I was another team that I would make that deal. Mm-hmm. So I think in order for them to be successful, with those two as your lead guys, they really have to be playing at their leadership has to be at another level. I just don't think it was at all. And you're so right. I mean, I kind of mentioned, you know, what Sabonis had career numbers, Brogdon, TJ McConnell, Doug McDermott. I know Justin Holiday did at one point. I can't remember.
Like half the year, he definitely was trending that way.
Yeah, and then he tapered off when he got a wrist injury around All-Star break. That he kind of kept quiet. That kind of affected him. But, yeah, so you look at all those guys with career seasons and you end up 4 games under .500. That math doesn't add up. And that really gets back to the leadership problem and the selfishness problem with guys playing for their own numbers or playing doing things the way they felt like they needed to do them. And they kind of was able to go off script, but only Brogdon and Sabonis were able to do it, I guess, without being criticized for it. So, it's a tough spot. I don't know. I don't believe that maybe if those two are your best guys, whether leadership wise or talent wise, I don't think they can get you to the conference finals. Maybe you guys disagree and think, you know, they can. I think it has to be somebody else that they got to find to bring into the mix, or one of those two guys have to make an incredible leap, not only in terms of leadership, but also in talent.
Yeah. It's a tough balance there because I mean, all the players on the starting five are good players, but nobody is like great. You know, it's what we've talked about, a lot of C and B level players, but no A level player. And you need that A level player to really be considered a serious, you know, contender in the Eastern Conference, especially with how this Eastern Conference is stacking up right now. And I think that's one thing Pritchard's kind of hit on. You know, I think we can compete, be a tough out for those teams 1 through 3, but I think he kind of knows with this roster that he has right now, it's going to be hard to get past the second round with his current roster. So before we get into coaching and stuff like that and candidates and all that, I know you've reported on that as well. I want to go back to the Sabonis conversation just because I think a lot of fans, including us, anticipate that he is the one that is safe over Turner, and Turner is probably the most likely to be traded. Do you anticipate them changing and trading anybody from the starting five to kind of get a little bit more modern, or do you think they try to, you know, make it work with these guys and just find a new coach to maybe fix the problems that they had last season?
You know, if Herb is going to have the ultimate say, I think it's more the latter. I think if Kevin gets his way, you're going to see more of the former. Mm-hmm. We're going to know where they're going to go with the roster real soon when they make the coaching hire. Because if they hire a veteran guy, a guy who, you know, I reported Mike Budenholzer already, if he became available, if Milwaukee moved on from him. If you have a coach like that, you know, Terry Stotts type of guy, that you're looking at a more veteran team, because a coach like that isn't going to really come to Indiana if he's going to deal with a rebuilding roster. They're not trying to deal with that, at least not to my knowledge. If they end up going with a younger coach or a guy who has some experience, but, you know, they may want to grow into the role and kind of build a team with this new coach and this new vision and shake up the roster and get all these new players in, you'll see that if they hire one of the other names I mentioned was Brian Shaw, who coaches the G League Ignite. Who they like, who's worked in Indiana briefly, who's been around and has more, even though he wasn't successful in Denver, he's still highly respected. He's a guy who probably could get you good, you know, people around him in terms of staff. So if you believe in a guy like him and you end up hiring a guy like him, I think there's more potential to see some major moves happen with the roster. I think the guy you should move on from ideally would be Sabonis, but Turner is the guy that's going to generate the most for whatever you get in the market. And like I said previously about Sabonis, are more people going to buy season tickets or buy tickets to go see Sabonis or Miles Turner at Bankers Life Fieldhouse or whatever it's going to be named going forward? They're going to pay more money to see Sabonis. And so that's the kind of dilemma I think Herb Simon will find himself in, because they know what all the metrics say in terms of ticket sales. And that factors in, you know, with a small market team more so than it would with any big market.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I do think that there are moves on the horizon. Moves have to occur. But, you know, some of the fan base feels that the Pacers likely don't fire Bjorkgren without, you know, maybe having something potentially lined up, which led a lot of us to feel like Terry Stotts could be the guy. Do you think the Pacers kind of knew the direction they were going when they fired Bjorkgren? Or was it, hey, you know, he's got to go and we'll take it from there?
He's got to go, man. They'll figure that stuff out later. There'll be more coaches come onto the market. Everybody's talking about Terry Stotts because he's the first name guy to leave, get fired from the team or become a free agent. If the first coach with a name to come free was Budenholzer, they'll be talking about Budenholzer. I don't really buy into that much, that because of that means – and Stotts, don't get me wrong, Stotts is a viable candidate. But I know for a fact Kevin Pritchard really likes Budenholzer. Really likes him. Now, would Budenholzer want the job? I don't know. He might not even want the job if he becomes a free agent himself. Or, but I know he is on the short list. When I say short list, I mean he would automatically be in the top two candidates for the Pacers for that job if he hit the market. But if they don't think he's going to hit the market and they're not, you know, and there's no need in waiting, then they'll make the move. They'll make the move sooner rather than later. But you know, as with every offseason, you're going to see different coaches hit the market, not just head coaches on some of these other teams, but, you know, some of their staff who are now currently in the playoffs who you're interested in talking to. You may not be able to talk to them right now, and you need to wait until things shake out there. But so Stotts is a viable guy, but I think Bjorkgren was such a train wreck. TBA was a better hire than keeping Bjorkgren in that spot. You'd rather go TBA, we'll figure it out later, is a better option right now than Nate Bjorkgren as the head coach.
How I got to ask, because I think Chauncey Billups is a name that's been kind of rumored all over the place for coaching candidacies, and I'm just curious how do the Pacers view a guy like that's never been a head coach but a former player who had – 1 year of assistant coaching this year under his belt. Do you think that that's a route they go, or do they want someone with more experience?
If the roster, I go back to what I said, if they keep a veteran roster, they want a veteran coach. But I mean, Chauncey Billups checks one box immediately that Bjorkgren couldn't, which is relationships with players before he even walks through the door. You know, he's already on good terms with guys like Brogdon. You know, so, you know, last year, when the whole coaching search was going on, my opinion was, I think a lot of people confuse when I say what my opinion is versus what the reporting and the facts say. My opinion is, if I'm going to take a gamble on a coach who doesn't have any experience, but you want somebody new, fresh, who can form good relationships with players, he would be the opposite of McMillan, and you want to really take a swing, Billups would have been my choice. I knew Billups wasn't their number one choice, but he was one of the, you know, three to five finalists that they had in mind. But Billups would have been my pick. Because he was my pick doesn't mean I'm saying that the Pacers were going to take him. Never said that. He would have just been my pick. If I was going to miss, I'd rather the whole NBA universe ridicule me for having hired Chauncey Billups for the job and fail than hire Nate Bjorkgren. That's kind of was my mindset. So I think a guy like Billups has potential. The problem is the experience isn't there if you keep a veteran roster. Now, I think if you believe you can get an A-plus staff to put around a guy like that, then maybe that's the move that you make. If you can get some name coaches to sit behind them, the way Mike D'Antoni came to sit behind Steve Nash, then that's a very viable option here. I don't think they'll go that route. Billups interviewed. When he interviewed with the Pacers last year, I was told that he knew he wasn't going to get the job, but he did the interview anyway because he wanted the experience. But he knew that he wasn't the number one choice. And I had another person tell me that he felt like it really was a token interview believed that the Pacers had already made up their mind that they were going to hire Bjorkgren. You know, several people who the Pacers talked to in terms of when they were backgrounding and checking on Bjorkgren before they made the hire felt like their minds really were – they were making it seem like they weren't sure what they were going to do, but their minds had already been made up that they were in a Bjorkgren camp, and I think Billups believed that as well. So I don't think Billups would end up on the short list this year. I could be wrong. I don't know right now at this moment. I think ideally he would have been the hire last year. That's the guy. I think if you swing and miss with Billups, I don't think you get the backlash for that hire that you get for a no-name guy like Bjorkman.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, Jay, we're starting to hear a couple of names linked to some other jobs. Like I heard Kenny Atkinson's interviewing for the Orlando Magic job. Becky Hammon's name starting to come up. D'Antoni has interest in the Trailblazers. I know you mentioned Brian Shaw and, Budenholzer, if he's let go. Is there any other names that you're hearing that could be some serious candidates for the Pacers' next hiring?
I haven't heard any other names that I would take seriously at the moment. Going back to what I said to you guys previously, a lot of the early stuff I find to be misdirection when it comes to coaching hires. Coaching hires become their teams are much more clandestine about their moves with coaches than it is with free agents, with players. I haven't heard any other names that would, I could say definitely would be on a short list of some sort, just the ones that I have, Stotts, Budenholzer, and Brian Shaw. This is a tricky time because I just always find if you look at some of the early list of who the Pacers were supposedly talking to or interested in and see where they were in the final rundown when they kind of pared down their list, most of those players weren't coaching candidates weren't on there. So I haven't gotten anything new on that. I think that's going to eventually shake out. And then at the same time, I really wouldn't be confident that any of it is totally accurate because they lie about coaching, not lie, but mislead about direction and where they're going with coaching more than anything else when it comes to hires in basketball. That's a tricky one.
Yeah. So in part of your report, you did mention some teams that have had or that have inquired about Miles Turner. You mentioned the Knicks, Lakers, Clippers, Hornets, and Pelicans. And you went on to say that the T-Wolves and the Hornets really want Turner. Like, really, dude, that's a quote that I stole from your Twitter. I'm just curious because, when I ask you about making significant changes or making a trade, do you think that trading Turner alone is making a significant move and shaking things up a lot? Or do you think it's more so like a minor move just to kind of retool a little bit with the core four of Brogdon, Sabonis, TJ Warren, and Caris LeVert?
And I think if you trade Turner, you're significantly changing your defensive concepts and who you are defensively. I think if you trade Turner, I'm trading a couple other pieces to change the complexion of the team. I think a lot, because is Goga going to be the rim protector that Turner is? I mean, off the bench, he can give you spot duty in that regard, but I'm not going to rely on him to be my defensive stopper night in and night out against A-list kind of guys. I think if you moved on from Turner, I think it would be probably Turner would be a centerpiece to the deal, but I think it would require other pieces to kind of rebuild the team in the image that you wanted. And, Charlotte has been – I asked when I said that the T-Wolves and Hornets really like him. That actually came from a couple of conversations I had earlier in that day with people who told me what they thought about Miles Turner. There's a lot of teams that like Turner. I mentioned the Lakers and all that stuff. They really want, they kicked the tires on Turner at the trade deadline, seeing they could get him away from the Pacers. Who wouldn't? I mean, if you're a championship level team trying to get there, if you can, get rid of your so-so center and put Miles Turner in there, sure, you would get him. The question is, who's willing to plunk down assets to acquire him? And that team, from what I gather right now, is Charlotte. And it's been the case that it's been Charlotte for a while. They're still smarting over passing over him for Frank Kaminsky. And why wouldn't it? And I think because they know that they missed out big time. Even if you don't think Turner's all that great, he's much better than Frank Kaminsky. And I think you might be able to leverage a little bit more from them. You know, it would be kind of weird. Wouldn't it be kind of weird if you ended up getting Gordon Hayward through a deal for Miles Turner through Charlotte? That would be hilarious. But I'm not saying that that would be the move they would make, but PJ Washington, as I've reported before, is the guy that they really like. The Pacers really like PJ Washington. Could you get PJ Washington, Terry Rozier type of deal, and, you know, for Turner and some other assets? And, you know, I guess you still would be missing a starting shot blocker if you did that. But, there's so much interest in Turner now. And it's kind of funny because after the deal with the Celtics fell through, and then, you know, I believe it was Danny Ainge who was pushing this narrative that they never really wanted Turner to begin with because he didn't have a lot of trade market value and made me fall over my chair laughing like that. You know, that's a way of covering your ass that you botched the deal. But the interest surrounding Miles Turner since that point and up to now says the exact opposite. There's a lot of interest in him. The question is, who's going to actually go that extra step beyond we really are interested in talking about him and making a deal to actually putting something on the table and trying to make a tangible move to get him? You know, obviously that hasn't happened yet, but that's what they're waiting to find out. What can they actually get in a deal before they kind of go down that path of, okay, let's move him, because they haven't gotten that yet. They haven't gotten any type of names put on the table on what they could get for Turner in return.
Alex and I have been in agreement for quite some time that we just feel that Turner fits so many more teams than Sabonis does. And it just, while their money is very comparable, it just feels like it's far more likely to be able to pull off a deal for Turner than it is for Sabonis at this point. But two other guys that are going to be free agents. I mean, the Pacers, outside of the mid-level exception, they have very limited room to work with this offseason. And between Doug McDermott and TJ McConnell, do you think either is coming back? And if so, which one?
McConnell.
I think so too.
McConnell's the more like, I've been talking to people about this for a while. It's going to be, the Pacers realize they're in an either or position with those two. And if you're going to end up keeping Sabonis, you might as well, if you're going to keep Sabonis, you would think you would keep Doug McDermott because the two of them play so well off of each other. And so that would be like, hey, that's one in the corner of Doug McDermott on why he stays. The problem is McDermott's going to command more money in the free agent market than TJ McConnell. That he's going to get more competitive, higher offers that the Pacers aren't willing to match than TJ McConnell. Even at the trade deadline, if you just go off of what happened at the trade deadline, I don't think a single call was made on behalf of any team trying to get TJ McConnell off of the Pacers. The phone was ringing off the hook with Doug McDermott. And I think the Pacers realize that as good as Doug is, you know, him playing well is contingent on having Domas. You know, we know what he looks like when Sabonis isn't on the floor. McConnell is going to be cheaper. So, you know, they really like that part, that he's going to cost less. Mm-hmm. And that he's more the hustle – the lack of hustle, the lack of effort, and the lack of grit that you saw in this group during long stretches, particularly in the second half of the season. TJ McConnell wasn't one of those guys that you could lecture for not playing hard. He always played hard. And and so he's kind of more part of the identity that they're hoping to reestablish. So in a way, he's more important to the kind of culture they want to have or bring back, the kind of style they want to have, the kind of grit. Whereas Doug McDermott is seen more as a luxury item. He's really good to have, especially with his 3-point shooting, but he's not necessary. And I think McConnell, aside from being less expensive, is seen as being more of a necessary asset for them based on, I think he's more valuable to the Pacers, TJ McConnell, than he would be to 29 other teams.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but I also wonder, because Aaron Holiday is a Pacers first-round draft pick from a few years ago, and obviously he did have a up-and-down season last year under Bjorkgren. What is the Pacers, you know, stance on Aaron Holiday going forward? And do you think that, you know, this could be the end of the road for him with the Pacers?
Look, going into the season when, you know, the whole thing about the Gordon Hayward trade and Boston wanted another piece, and Aaron Holiday was a player they would not put in that deal. They've been high on Aaron Holiday for, you know, for a while now. But I think when we go into next season, they have to spit or get off the pot when it comes to that. To me, if you're going to say Aaron Holiday is the guy, then maybe you should let TJ McConnell walk and keep McDermott instead. But I don't think you can have TJ McConnell and Aaron Holiday coming off that bench. I see that as bad for both sides. Holiday, what, he shot less than 40% from the field this year. Less than, like, he had shot 40% from three the previous seasons. I think he was way under 40% this year, right? Mm-hmm. His efficiency just tapered off. Obviously, he had the toe injury to end the season, which, you know, he didn't end it strongly. But I just don't think – I think he has to be put in a situation like I think the ceiling for him, and it's not a bad ceiling, is Lou Williams type of guy. He's a guy you bring in the game, you play 15 to 17 minutes. If he gets hot, he can get you 15 to 18 points in that period of time and help you win a game. But if he gets out there – and he's cold, you probably got to bench him right away. Like, I think that's the role where he maximizes. And I don't think the Pacers have necessarily used him the right way. And I think in part because of the logjam that's created with the way TJ McConnell has played the last two seasons is part of that. So they got to make a decision, in my opinion, which way they want to go with that. And I remember coming into this past season, I expected Aaron Holiday to request a trade from the Pacers. He changed agents, and so that didn't happen. I don't know if that was part of the reason why that didn't happen. But I think now, after you saw him under Bjorkgren, and even though it was Bjorkgren under that one season, I think he wants to play some – I don't think. I'm pretty confident he wants to play somewhere else. Will it come to the point to where he will come there and make a demand? I don't know. But if that doesn't happen, I think the Pacers need to look at what they can do to get him in a better situation and obviously to better their own situation, because I think he's growing stale as he sits there and we're not really able to see what he can be. I think he's a better player than what he showed this season under Bjorkgren. I expected actually him to be one of the guys that would benefit from Bjorkgren coming in, but that turned out not to be the case.
I think we all had, you know, higher expectations for Aaron Holiday coming into this year. I mean, obviously, from a trade value standpoint, you know, there was a lot of talks that the Pacers could have gotten a first-round pick in previous years for him. And then when you talked about potentially, you know, asking for a trade, I wasn't sure if maybe it was his group that was putting out some feelers when saying that the Pacers could look at trading Aaron Holiday or taking calls, but no deal ended up happening. One player whose, you know, season started late and ended prematurely, Jeremy Lamb. He's still trying to recover from that ACL tear, and at $10.5 million expiring, do you see him on the roster to start next season?
I would say ideally he wouldn't be. I think he's a luxury item that you could do. He's nice to have, but he's one that you could replace. The problem that you're going to have with that, I know he's expiring, and that makes his contract – and it's not – an albatross sort of contract anyway. It's not like you're paying him $25 million a year or something. I think a team that's really good, that needs another score, a microwave type of guy, the kind of guy I think Aaron Holiday could ideally be, one of those guys that come off the bench and just like get you buckets. I think he's very valuable for an established veteran team that's contending. But the question is, where exactly is his leg? Because, you know, he tore that leg. That's the one where he broke the bones and tore the ligaments in. And maybe he's too damaged goods right now to where there's no value for him right now out there. Like, you could trade for him as an expiring. Maybe that's what he is. But I think that injury is kind of handicapped his ability to garner interest. Unless your sole reason is to acquire him as a expiring and maybe waive him.
waive him and pay him to go away and open that salary slot. But as a guy who can contribute for a team right now that can win, I don't know. I think that injury kind of puts a lot into question, because that was a pretty significantly, you know, he got banged up pretty badly. And I was surprised he didn't play again during the season. I thought he was going to come back at any point. That tells me that the recurrence of whatever issues he was having was pretty major.
Yeah, and I want to talk about another guy that was injured for most of the season. That's TJ Warren. This is the guy that had an amazing bubble, and when he came back this year, just did not look right, and then ended up having the surgery. And, you know, there was a report from Jake Fisher from Bleacher Report saying that he had requested a trade, and I think that was shot down by TJ and multiple sources, that he did not request a trade. And, you know, he was in the know with Pritchard on the Bjorkgren hire and all that kind of stuff. But Kevin Pritchard really praised TJ Warren in his end-of-season presser. I just kind of want to get your thoughts on how you think this organization views TJ Warren, especially heading into a contract year this upcoming season.
They love TJ because TJ is a guy that they got for nothing from Phoenix, and he actually wants to be in Indiana. He's not a guy who was coming off of a great season and decided he wanted to leverage his way out and go to a bigger market. So, you know, you don't find too many guys like that around the league. So they really value him for that reason. You know, the report you were referencing, like that same day, I talked to four people with direct knowledge of what happened, what went down with TJ. I think I put that out on Twitter. I'm pretty confident based off of who I've talked to. TJ Warren never requested a trade from Indiana. But you know, when things go sideways in a season, then everything just starts to kind of spill out. And I think some signals may have gotten crossed. Maybe they confused him with, I was told early on that, Sabonis had requested a trade, which, I didn't report it. So, but that was being said a lot. The same people who were saying that also said TJ Warren had requested a trade, and I knew Sabonis had not. So the information that was being dispensed was not even firsthand. And so I think somehow it just kind of snowballed into something more than what it was. Of course, being a reporter that I am, players are always going to deny something is true that doesn't look good. So whether TJ requested a trade or not, I expected him to say it wasn't true. A certain other player said stuff I reported about him wasn't true, and it was 100% true. So public denials aren't necessarily proof of anything either, and that's where people get fooled. Like somebody denies it publicly. Oh, see, therefore it's telling the truth. Bull crap. There's plenty of things that have been denied publicly. Like, I didn't have sex with that woman. Like, but we know it happened, right? So people deny stuff publicly all the time. I made a report on Aaron Holiday in his rookie year being almost traded to Memphis. And I think Kevin denied that it was true publicly on Twitter. It was true. Okay. So that trade fell through only because Herb Simon didn't let it go through. That deal was done for Mike Conley to come to Indy. And that's why signals get crossed a lot, because people don't understand or don't realize, you know, just because somebody did that doesn't make it fact. But when it came to TJ, there were enough people who I know, who I talk to directly. But also, if you know TJ Warren, I met TJ when he was 15 years old, playing in the AAU program for David West called Garner Road. And back then, he barely ever said two words. TJ's personality, he's not that kind of dude. He's not the kind of guy that's going to go to management and say, I want out, or this person needs to be fired. If you know anything about him, his personality, that's completely against anything. That's like somebody telling you they saw me eating pizza with pineapples on it. If you know me, you know that's not true. You don't even have to. You know I find that absolute, putting fruit on pizza is disgusting. It never would happen.
Preach.
You never ask another question about it. Same thing with TJ. That's not in his DNA to do that, number one. He was unhappy with Nate McMillan being fired, because of his relationship with McMillan, both from Raleigh, North Carolina, both went to NC State. Nate is tight with knows his dad and came up playing basketball with his dad, Tony Sr. But he's not the kind of guy. I don't I never got from I don't think T.J. Warren loved Bjorklund. I'm not even sure if he liked him, but he didn't dislike him enough to say, I want out of here because you hired him. And that's a completely different thing. But the franchise loves him because of his commitment and willingness to play defense. He has kind of that, you know, when I talk about T.J. McConnell, that kind of attitude that they want to have on the team to help build that kind of culture. I think T.J. Warren has that kind of attitude and grit. And so they want to keep guys like that, and they think he fits. And T.J. Warren knows that if he wants to get paid, that Indiana can pay him, and Indiana wants to pay him. And unless somehow the Pacers say lowball him and say they don't want to do the right thing to pay him whatever he thinks his value is, as long as Indiana's willing to pay him, and I think the Pacers are, then he's going to stay.
So we know that T.J. Warren's someone who doesn't speak often, but when he does, it packs a punch, like when he refuted the trade rumors that came out. And we obviously know the fan base loves him. Front office speaks very highly of him. He's entering a contract here, just like we talked about. Wants to be here. Pacers want him. Do you think the Pacers might try and get ahead on it and sign into a long-term deal before the season, or is that just too risky given his injury history?
I think they're going to try to do it before the season. That's a hunch. I don't know that for a fact at this moment, but I think they're going to try to get ahead of it. You know, this is a franchise that can't wait. They're in a tough spot because, again, guys like him, if you let him become a free agent, then, you know, you never know what can happen there. And the Pacers are always up against the eight ball in the free agent market to get guys of T.J. Warren's caliber or better. So I think they're going to go with Bird in hand. If he's willing to make a move now, and resign or get an extension or whatever it may be, they want to get that done sooner rather than later. I mean, the foot injury, the foot injury takes the kind of foot injury he has. The issue isn't so much that they're worried that it's going to be a long-term thing, but that that injury he has takes so long to heal because of the placement of the injury, because it's hard to get blood flow there. It's more about that than it is, wow, he could have a recurrence and maybe he'll be hurt the rest of his career. I don't think they have, based off of the diagnoses that they've made on TJ, that's not a concern for the team. So as a result of that, plus TJ wanting to be here and getting this out of the way, I think they're more, just like they made the deal when Kevin Pritchard traded Paul George, when he traded Oladipo, seems to be his MO is to make the move, if you believe in the move, instead of waiting it out, just make it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and so one of my last questions here for you, Jay, it's really just talking about this upcoming draft, and I know the draft lottery is in a couple weeks, and Pacer fans are excited to see where they'll end up picking if it's not 13th, but how do you think the franchise values this upcoming draft?
What, can you ask that one more time?
How do you think the franchise values this upcoming draft pick?
Oh, I think they value it very highly, much more than they did the previous draft. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about this draft too is like this is probably the draft I'm entering because I'm trying to catch up to speed because I'm completely in the dark about half this draft because of the way how crazy the season has been. Like everything right. is off. I've been off schedule. My timing is off and when I normally watch things. But I think they value this draft probably more. The one of the reasons why, you know, like say back in March, I think I reported that if the Pacers were going to make a trade at the deadline, they were going to trade for somebody who could help them right now, like a veteran guy. They weren't trying to get future picks because that wasn't going to really move the needle. I think that's been the case probably the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I think now when they're looking at, you know, kind of if you're looking at shaking things up a little bit, I think they value this draft coming up a little bit more. And you know, can they find that rookie that, I mean, most rookies, as we know, picked where the Pacers are going to end up picking. At least this rookie might end up being more NBA ready than where they picked before. What, 23 Aaron Holiday, 18 with Goga Batase. That, you know, getting in a little bit better draft position is going to help him. Maybe get a more NBA ready player. So I think as a result, they value this one a little bit more.
Yeah, and I was going to say, just to echo that, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. If they did make that, you know, Hornets trade, because I know that you said they're really high on PJ Washington, getting a draft pick and hitting on it, you know, a younger guy, maybe 19, 20 in this year's draft, and, you know, having a little bit of a young core in a PJ Washington and in this draft pick, if they hit on it, that kind of sets them up future-wise in case they feel like, hey, they've reached the ceiling with this team over the next 2 years. Now they can start building around PJ Washington in this draft pick.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, the other player who I would throw in that mix, who I'm curious what they end up doing with this offseason, is Cassius Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
Another young guy who a lot of people thought was a steal, who basically did not play nearly enough on a team four games under 500. I think they're actually high on him. I'm actually curious about that in terms of the draft. So yeah, I really like PJ Washington. I think, yeah, that could start them off going into another direction. If you're able to, and you have a lot of wings, cause think about it. Like you would have what, PJ Washington, you'd have TJ Warren, who else? You got guys who could play
LeVert.
So you have a whole bunch of guys who are interchangeable. You could play a lot of small ball. PJ Washington played a lot of five in Charlotte and did a hell of a good job at it too. Cause
he's
really long. Really did.
Yeah. He's a good pick. He's actually a good pick and roll defender switching, on smaller guys. You know, he's not the most athletic, fastest guy in the world, but I think he gauges his timing and distance pretty well. I love a guy like that. I think if you were to move off of a Miles Turner, even though Washington isn't going to be the rim protector, but I think you have – I like the diversity of the roster if you do that. And, yeah, and if you hit on a draft pick, that really moves you up a few notches. And I really believe – I mentioned Cassius Stanley only because I think a disservice was done in terms of not getting more of a look at him, because – I don't know what he is, but I think he potentially could be one of those guys that could end up when you remake the team, who could maybe have a significant role. I could be wrong, but Bjorkgren didn't really do it. I mean, there were games where the Pacers were losing by 40 and Cassius Stanley played like 2 minutes.
Yeah, like, Sabonis played 40.
I know the front office wasn't crazy about that. They wanted to see more of Cassius Stanley too.
Yeah.
I think that could really springboard you into the future, being able to build a team, but you have to hit on a draft pick, and that's not always a guarantee.
Yeah, it's not, but I really do think that this draft class, from what I've done with talking to other people, just kind of getting a feel for it, I really do feel like, you know, having a lottery pick in this year's draft, you could land somebody special, but, you know, they say that every year. So, all right, Jay, well, we're gonna wrap this up. Did you have anything you wanted to plug as far as article-wise?
Man, I'm taking some time off, man.
I figured. It's been a long year.
Man, I feel really beat up, run down. This season was tough. And I think maybe if the Pacers had a better year, it would have been easier. But there was so much drama and there's so much crap to wade through. It actually made it. It made it harder. And if you listen to any of the post-game interviews that they did via Zoom, like sometimes you rarely hear me ask a question. Sometimes I never ask anything. Even at Pritchard's final press Zoom call this season, I listened in because there's nothing else. Unless something comes up that's new that I don't already know about, it's like, what else new can I hear? It's like the same crap. I almost said another word, all the time, especially after some of those losses. I was like, what's the point of me even pressing Bjorkman on this issue or that issue? It doesn't matter. He's not going to say anything. It's the same old stuff, you know. And as a result, it became the last month was a real drag. So I hope to not do anything on the Pacers here, at least for the next month, so I can recharge. But I think they'll probably make a coaching hire by then. So maybe I have to jump in and do something.
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, what do you anticipate that hire being within the next couple of weeks, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, before the draft. I can't wait. What day is the draft? See, I should.
It's July 29th, I believe. So we've got a month and a half.
Yeah, so they got time, and they know that. So me saying before the draft is still a long period of time.
Right, but, right.
I think whenever we find out Budenholzer's future, unless they already know they can't get him, if they know regardless of what happens with Milwaukee, Bud isn't interested in coaching the Pacers, there's another job he's interested in, or financially they're not going to be in the same ballpark as what Bud's demanding, then they'll just move on and move on to what else. But I know they really want a chance to talk to him and explore that opportunity if he's willing to do so. And I think a lot could depend on that. I'd be surprised if they made a hire in the next week or two, but but stranger things have happened. But I expected to take, I'm looking at maybe 3 weeks out, or something like that. When something happens, it's hard to predict with these things.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it was 2 months before the firing and hiring of, or 2 months in between the firing and hiring of old Nate to new Nate. So yeah, we'll see what happens, but I do think that those dates are important in terms of the draft and trying to figure out your roster heading into the draft. So anyway, Jay, thank you so much for coming on and going on lengthy with us. We really appreciate it.
No problem, guys. Anytime.
All right, Faji. So pretty lengthy episode there with Jay Michael, but thought it was very insightful.
It definitely learned a lot. I mean, this was a strange year. I mean, there was a lot less media access than ever before. So Jay was really, dropping some very interesting tidbits here, left and right. And it just sounds like at the end of the day, the Pacers had to move on from Nate Bjorkgren, make a change. And it sounds like there's going to be more changes to come.
Yeah, just not sure. I was really intrigued by what he had to say about Charlotte having a ton of interest in Miles Turner and then going all the way back to the 2015 draft when they selected Frank Kaminsky over him with the ninth pick, I believe, when they had that in the draft because Justice Winslow went 10th to the Miami Heat. So, yeah, I mean, I get why Charlotte would be really interested in Miles Turner. If the Pacers could somehow get P.J. Washington in that deal, I think it makes a ton of sense, and I think Pacer fans understand why the Pacers might have to change it up a little bit just because playing two centers in today's NBA is just a really hard thing to, do successfully. I think the Pacers have done an okay job with it, but at the end of the day, their on-off numbers just glare and scream at you, hey, we are better with just one center.
It's true. I mean, like I said numerous times, it's different for a reason. It's run its course. We've done 4 years with the Tabonis, duo, and I think at this point, it's time for a change.
Absolutely. So hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We'll be back later this week. We have some more mock trade scenarios for you guys. We were going to tie one in with this episode, but with it being pretty lengthy, we will save that for another day. We have a really cool one with a Charlotte Hornets guy. So we'll be talking all things Pacers Hornets in a mock trade. Facci played Chad Buchanan and our guest played Mitch Kupchak for the Charlotte Hornets. So that'll be a really fun conversation. But Facci, where can the people find us at on social media?
So you can find us on Twitter at SettingThePace3. You could find Alex on Twitter at AlexGoldenNBA. You could find me on Twitter at _FACCI. And you could find us on Instagram at PacersTalk.
And at the end of the day, we all know what you are, so stand up and say these three words.
Let's go, Pacers!